Welcome to Living Healthy Together. This week, we're talking about stroke care, stroke education, and awareness. There's so much to talk about in this space, from the amazing medications that help save people's lives to the amazing work done by everyone from the first responders to the folks in the emergency department, neurological care teams that work with people in the hospitals and at home to give them care and support. I'm very pleased to welcome Jeannie Denton and her husband, Steve Hernoyes, a firefighter and EMT for more than 35 years. Jeannie is an administrative assistant in the emergency department at Central Vermont Medical Center. Jeannie, you have a medical journey to share. Tell us about your most recent experience with a stroke.
The day began like any other, and we were at our home in Northfield trying to work around the house, and I wasn't quite feeling like myself that day. I was like really lethargic, and I made a comment to Steve that I was not going to be very helpful and that I didn't know why, other than to say, this is going to sound weird, but my feet feel really heavy today. And it's almost like I'm a character on when you watch the moon launch landing, that I've got these heavy legs. And so he just did some work, and partway through the day, he looked at me and said, boy, I don't think you're feeling okay. And then we went home to have dinner, and I am a diabetic, so I went to give myself my insulin, which is given in a pen with a little needle on it. And suddenly I felt dizzy, and Steve looked at me and said, what's going on? And I said, it's the darndest thing. I said, I don't know where I'm at with my medicine. And he said, what are you talking about? You're holding it in your hand. And I said, that's just it. I can't see my hand. I said, I can see my left hand. I said, but my right hand is completely gone. And then we kept talking, and I said, oh, wait a minute. This is going to sound crazy, I said, but it's like I'm in a sci-fi movie. I said, oh, there's some flashes. I can see my pinky now. Oh, wait, now I can see my other finger. But the rest of my hand and the medicine that I'm holding are gone. I can no longer visually see them.
We're still at the very beginning of your story, and it's already mind-bending to me. I don't understand how you remained calm when this is happening. There are, for me, things that kind of live in my head as the things I never want to have happen. And one of them is losing my eyesight. So how did you remain calm in this scenario? That sounds terrifying.
I think that it was scary, but because you're in it, like you might be scared to go on a roller coaster, but once you're on the ride, there's no getting off of it. And also a lot of things were happening really quickly for me. As soon as I started to be able to see my hand again, then I started to feel sick. And as soon as I said that stuff with my hand, that's when Steve said,
you just earned yourself a trip to the hospital.
He wanted to call an ambulance. And we actually have had this debate more than once.
Yeah.
And I said, I don't want you to call an ambulance. They're very expensive. And he's, I don't care. We're going to the hospital. Your choice, ambulance or car. We're moving now. But we got in the car. I was feeling really dizzy, and it was harder to form my words. And then we arrived at the hospital, CBMC, which I had just started my job at. There are a lot of holes, I think, in my story, because it is a weird time and your brain is having a little tantrum. I remember, and this to this day still makes me smile, nurses or doctors trying to take what I felt was my blood pressure through my legs and ankles. I think now they might have been looking for a DBT or a clot of some sort. And I had told them that they started uncharacteristically with really heavy legs that felt weird. But I remember in my head thinking, these silly professionals, you don't take blood pressure through your person's ankles. And I know that makes no sense. It's just this crazy thought I have at that moment. I remember people like, we're going to take your blood pressure. And then them feeling around my ankles and me thinking, That's so silly.
It's so funny what you do and don't remember from these experiences. We're laughing and joking about it now, but these are capital T traumatic experiences, and what your brain decides to hold on to and what it decides to put to the side. It's really fascinating. One of the many amazing pieces of stroke care are the medications that are life-changing in the event of certain types of strokes. Is this something that was applicable to your experience, Jeannie? You're in the ED, you're connected via telemedicine, neurological expert. How did medication play a role in responding to?
I believe that I did receive the medicine, part of it being because it was witnessed. When was I last known to be without my altered mental status that was happening? And how I was already at a heightened awareness that it could be a stroke that I would be having.
And for our listeners out there, the medication that Jeannie is talking about and that I'm talking about, these are clot-busting medications if they are administered within that golden window, which I believe is about 2 hours. They have an incredibly high rate of success of resolving the clot, restoring blood flow, resolving the stroke without severe damage. You mentioned, Jeannie, having some history here. This isn't your first experience with a stroke or with stroke-related care. So tell us what happened that put this on your radar.
In 2021, Steve and I were dating, and I previously had some vision problems where I had a vitreal detachment. And so I had gone to a retina specialist and was having a follow-up visit with Dr. Millay, who's actually still a doctor at UVM. And about a week before I was due to have my follow-up visit, I woke up one morning and I couldn't see out of one eye. And I can't put it into a sense of time, but eventually it was like a shade gets lifted up and I can suddenly see again. Now, I, not being very stroke aware, but having had recent eye problems, thought, oh, this is another one of those eye things. And good thing I've already got my appointment with the retina specialist in a few days. I'll mention it. And I was supposed to have that appointment and then go out for a nice dinner. We had reservations at a nicer restaurant. So I went to the eye doctors and Dr. Millay did his entire exam and told me where I was at with my vitreal detachment. He said, your eye's progressing well. I want to see you back in a year for that. However, right now I need you to go over to the emergency room and meet the brain team. And I looked at him like, that's crazy. I don't think I need to do that because I'm feeling fine at that moment. And he says, no, you need to go do that now because the story you told me is not an eye problem. It's a brain problem. And I need you to go over there right now. And I was thinking, that's crazy. My reservation for dinner is coming up real soon. I could probably do this another day. I literally am talking to him like this. And he calls his administrative staff and says, I've got this patient here. She's done with her exam. And I need you to go show her where the emergency department is. I need you to take her there. And so they walked me over to the emergency room. And I sent Steve a text saying, I'm going to be a little late for dinner. But I don't tell him anything's going on. I don't tell him a thing, but I'm there for a really long time. So finally, I'm like, I'm going to have to cancel dinner. I'm really sorry. And I said, by the way, do you have a charger, phone charger on you? Don't get worried. There's a little thing happening here. If you could just bring me the phone charger in the emergency room. And so he agrees to bring the phone charger to the emergency room. And I love this part because, again, I have no clue like I do today about how an emergency room is set up with the acute rooms and trauma rooms being where they are stationed and numbered, et cetera, and located. Steve, in this case, was living in Essex Junction, an active firefighter and EMT who's always going over to the emergency room with the patients. And when he arrives, here's your phone charger. And he said, what's going on? And why are you in this room? And I thought, what a weird question. What are you talking about? This is the room they put me in. He goes, no, but why are you in this room, Jeannie? And I go, what are you talking about? He's these rooms. This is where people die. This is where we do CPR. This is the trauma room. What is going on? And I didn't realize that. It wasn't long after Steve arrived that the brain team comes back in and they say to me, and it feels very surreal at this moment, and they say, you've had a stroke, and in fact, you've had more than one. And the way the imaging comes back, we can't tell when it was, but you've had more than one. And then we go down a journey of, can you think of any time in your life that you may have had a stroke? And I knew exactly the moment that they were talking about. It's the only one I can think of, which is, this is going to sound also crazy. As the single parent, I was alone with my young kids, and I was scrolling on the computer the way many of us do with that little mouse, like zoom, zoom, scrolling. And suddenly, I felt like my scrolling had given myself a seizure. And I just had this moment where it felt like womp, womp happening to my head. And I remember barely making it to the couch and thinking, oh my gosh, I don't know what the heck is going on. I've given myself a seizure. I don't know how I'm going to get to the phone to call 911. And then I just laid on the couch and eventually it stopped and I was able to move forward. I just remember feeling really tired after that event. Today, I still can't be near scrolling. It makes me feel like I'm about to have the same thing happen. So I can't be anywhere near anyone who's just zooming on their computer. And then I would again have another one. It was right near my kids' graduation. I dropped my children off for their graduation practice. And I am with my cousin. We're going to go out to eat after I drop them off. As soon as I pull out of the school parking lot, again, it feels like womp womp to my head. And then I remember trying to get out of the car and I could not really get out of the car right. And eventually this time passes. And this is after I learned about the possibility of stroke. And my cousin calls Steve and we have this conversation. So it's on my radar at this point, and I'm thankful. Because when the incident happened on October 19th, 2024, at that point, we've already discussed how I need to get to the emergency room fast, how I cannot ignore these signs and symptoms, which I do think people do often. I think, especially because with the vision one, with the day I woke up and I couldn't see out of one eye, I'm not in pain. So you think to yourself, I'll just wait. Oh, look, time's gone by and I can see again. So if I had a message to people, it's not to ignore it. It's to immediately seek medical care. I've learned that. I now have a medic alert bracelet I wear that says that I'm high risk for stroke so that people are hopefully looking to check that right away.
Jeannie, I know for you, it's really important to share your story and to share that message of awareness. What's it like to work with the people in the emergency department at CVMC now? Who probably had a role in maybe saving your life is too strong a phrase, but in preserving your ability to live your life the way that you live it now.
No, I think that I do feel like they saved my life that day. I think it was really important for me to get to the hospital and to get that medicine. Today, I do have residual impact of having had a stroke. I don't have good grip strength in one of my hands. I can't really use two of my fingers on my right hand. I can't feel my face, half of my face. It feels constantly, the feeling that people could relate to is that it feels like I've gone to the dentist and had a cavity filled and the Novocaine's just wearing off, but it never wears off. It feels tingly. And I am thankful that's the only known repercussions that I suffered from the last one. And I definitely attribute that to that whole be fast motto and going to be seen. And today, when I work with my colleagues, I have a lot of respect and appreciation for them. And I know that we all play an important role in working miracles. And I think that the other part of that is I find myself very empathetic and sympathetic to the families, because you'll see them sometimes be very upset that why didn't I bring my spouse sooner or my parent sooner, beating themselves up about it. And I definitely find myself like, I know the symptoms of a stroke. And when I see a person coming to check in, I am their best advocate because I'm making sure that the staff know we've got someone here that's time sensitive that could potentially be in a similar situation. And I'm really sensitive to that. I don't remember a lot of the staff in the emergency room that day, but I do remember the staff in the hospital during my hospital stay. And they were all wonderful and lovely. And it was so great to see like speech therapy coming up into my room during my hospital stay and some of those assessments that I would need. What kind of OT and PT journey are you going to be on afterwards and that occurring? It's interesting to see what a web we weave and how everybody's role in different areas of the hospital plays a part in the patient's success.
We're going to take a quick break and be back with more about strokes, the risk factors, what you need to know, how you can help yourself, and what clinicians and hospitals are looking at as focuses about stroke care grow and change. We'll be right back here on Living Healthy Together. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together, where this week we're talking about strokes, stroke care, and trying to raise awareness about stroke signs and symptoms. I'm joined now by Dr. Christopher Comichau, Director of Cerebrovascular Disease, Neurocritical Care, and the Director of the Stroke Center for UVM Health, and Jenna Wydra, a registered nurse and the Stroke Program Manager for UVM Health. Jenna, you also have a bunch of specialty certifications in stroke care and probably neurocritical care as well. Really pleased to have you both here on the show together. Let's start with awareness, because we just heard from Jeannie Denton and her husband, Steven, who both are EMTs, have worked in healthcare for a long time. She didn't recognize the signs and symptoms of a stroke when it happened to her. So let's start there. Let's talk about the information people need to know to recognize a stroke when it happens, or even a possible stroke.
I like what you said, people who are possibly suffering a stroke. And that's key, because you don't know. And you walk into the emergency room, they don't know. It's not as easy as you simply examine somebody and say, aha, there it is. There's all sorts of imaging. There's all sorts of piecing together of the symptoms that you have. Do they make sense from a neurologic perspective to suggest that it's a disruption of normal blood flow? For neurologists, there certainly are patterns that are almost like, certainly, yes, this is a stroke. But it's not just as simple as anybody can just say, yeah, symptom X, Y, and Z is definitely a stroke. And there are different types of stroke. So there are ones that are a blockage of blood flow. There's some that are bleeding. And they all have a little bit of a different, how should I say, feel to them, a little bit of a different approach once you determine that, different treatments. The first step is to say, aha, these symptoms might be consistent with a stroke. I better get myself or get my loved one or my friend or my this person, this stranger who I see having these symptoms, get them some help immediately. And the help that is needed is your nearest emergency room. And you don't go out of your way and drive 2 hours to a place that you prefer. You get to the nearest emergency room closest to you.
I know that there are a variety of symptoms. Are there symptoms that are most common, that are easiest for people to recognize? What's the spectrum here of the awareness that people need to have about these events?
For a really long time, FAST was the way to go, the FAST. But in recent history, we've added the B and the E to it. The B and the E are going to better identify if a patient's having a stroke in the back of their brain. And those are a lot of the types of stroke presentations that walk into our ERs. The ones that fall into the FAST mnemonic, they tend to be the ones that are a little bit more obvious, the ones you call 911 for, or the ones people historically called 911 for. But really, the B and the E additions to the FAST exam are very important for the public to become familiar with. So B stands for balance. E stands for a sudden change in vision in one or both eyes. And then the F is a facial droop. The A is arms, or really any sudden onset of an extremity weakness, usually on one side of the body. S is a change in speech. And then T is for time. We need to move really fast. And then also, what time did this all start? Because that really drives the neurologist's evaluation for some of the treatments people can get. So be fast is really what we need people to remember, to be fast. And then also, really important to this is how the symptoms came on. Neurologists are particularly concerned with those be fast symptoms that come on suddenly. Not a progressive change of leg weakness, meaning you've noticed that your legs are a little weak over the last couple of weeks. You're noticing this decline, the sudden onset of those symptoms that is of particular importance. And I do believe that is some of what Jeannie experienced. And the B and the E tends to be what trips people up these days or delays them from getting medical care.
One of the things that's most incredible to me about Jeannie's story, which is incredible soup to nuts, is the awareness of her eye doctor, who picked up the phone and said, you need to go to the ER right now, because that's not an eye problem. That's a neurological problem. How did you and your colleagues manage to make awareness of this happen across medical specialties?
As a diagnosis, takes not even a village, an entire system to do it right. What happens at one of our community hospitals is really important in the patient's care and outcome. Our focus, it's always been on how can we optimize the system to make sure that a patient in a rural area of our state or in our system can get the same care than somebody who shows up to the ED at UVM, where we have all the specialists. And so I think that it's essential that we continue to support our rural areas and build our systems to close those disparities and make sure that the people in our catchment area, in our region, can get that specialized, high-quality stroke care, regardless of where they live. So that's something that we work really hard on in our program. And with that, we've talked a little bit about caregivers, but the caregivers are a really important part of the stroke patient care team. And most of the recovery, almost all of the recovery, happens when a patient leaves our facility. And so we have a really strong focus on building up the post-discharge support that we can give our stroke patients throughout the region. And we anticipate within the coming year to add additional resources to close those gaps from when the patient discharges until their first appointment, ensure that caregivers are aware of the medications, the signs and symptoms, prevent further complication, prevent readmissions, which really task our system as a whole. Closing those disparities and focusing on caregivers and what happens to the patient after they're in our care. I feel really confident at this point that when they are in our care, fantastic things are happening. From the neurological standpoint, I feel really confident in our system. And so it really is important that we work through the continuum and have a good idea of what's happening to our patients when they leave us.
Jenna said something, she has confidence in our system. I agree with that, but I'm worried about it, right? Our system is fragile. And the whole topic is challenges of healthcare. I think that's what you let out with, Phil. And no doubt we face challenges. We all know the stories of the costs, and they're out of control. We have to do something to get things under control. Yet, we also have to advance medical care and provide the best care. We can't skimp on that. So somehow we have to figure out how do we get costs contained, but provide that top-notch care and its resources. I want to put in a plug for Mike, for our team. If you saw behind the scenes of what Jenna does and what all the faculty, all our other stroke doctors, how thin they are stretched, what they do 24 hours a day, up in the middle of the night, taking care of somebody over in New York by video or what have you, and trying to coordinate care. It's amazing. I'm proud of what we do. And the community deserves that. They deserve nothing less. But we have real challenges, and it's a fragile system. We have to keep doing this. We have to advance it, but we have to do it smarter. And I want people to understand that we're working our tails off. And it's really important for us. It's really important for you. We face challenges of personnel. I would love to have more people to do these jobs so people could be fresh all the time. We face real issues with transport. We serve a rural area where time is of the essence. And when we don't have transport that can get people here immediately, yeah, I wish things were better.
These are medical events where literally every second counts and can make a difference between returning to your life basically at the same capacity that you used to have, or having your life change dramatically and being almost a different person. My uncle Zip, who suffered a stroke, Zip used to be the guy that you didn't want to play Scrabble against. I had never seen the man lose a game of Scrabble, and we are a Scrabble family. That is not who he is anymore. And as a family member, you feel a loss. He's still here. He's still Uncle Zip, but he's a different version of himself and will never get back the person that he was, even though he's okay, quote unquote, okay now. So that transport system matters. Where you live matters, right? You can't snap your fingers and create a hospital within 20 minutes of your house if you live in rural Vermont or you live in the North Country. And so the system matters. There's been a ton of work and a ton of advances that have happened. CVMC becoming a primary stroke center, UVM Medical Center being certified as a comprehensive stroke center. Can you talk about what those things mean in a way that makes sense to mom and dad?
It's much more important than maybe people would realize. And first of all, what it means to me is that this community at UVMMC, senior leaders, our department, they are all behind this. They support this. They understand what it is, a commitment to quality. It is a commitment to the fact that Chris and I have really high standards, and everybody is going to jump through those hoops with us to ensure that we can do the best for the patients in our community. And in order to have an effective stroke system of care, you need a comprehensive stroke center. That means that we provide top of the line and of all the different procedures that somebody could get with advanced stroke. And so we have committed to that. We meet all of those standards. We provide all of those procedures and the care that someone may possibly need. But then our system needs that, because while our other hospitals are providing stroke care, there are patients who do remain local. When they need something more, they have a place to go. They can stay right within our system. That is really important. It also, for a place like CVMC, it means that they have committed to that same high standard of quality. And this is a really regulated diagnosis. We know a ton about. When we know better, we do better. It's very dynamic. The care changes all the time. They're finding out new things all the time. And so that's taxing on the system to change your pathways and change your workflows. And that's something that at the Academic Medical Center, we have the opportunity of doing. We have that academic piece behind it to continuously be learning and making sure that we're up to the highest level of standard for the care. And so that really to the commitment that everybody is making to provide the highest level that we have. And I always say, just because we are a relatively small network doesn't mean that we can't be a extremely high quality stroke program, which again is what I think we have achieved with this system.
We should have talked about prevention first. There is so much here to talk about, and it's so interesting. There are so many things that you can do to positively or negatively impact your health and wellness in any realm, right? But specifically for stroke.
I hear a lot that people do not know how to prevent a stroke. And a huge proportion of strokes could be prevented. And I like to simplify by saying heart health is brain health, because I do believe that the general public can oftentimes tell me or tell somebody how to keep their heart healthy. And that's really how you're going to keep the vessels in your brain healthy. The American Heart Association has Life's Essential 8, when they talk about these are the different things that you can modify in your life to decrease your risk of heart attack and stroke. And so it is really important that the general public even tie those two together, but the traditional risk factors for cardiovascular disease are really the same for stroke. And so those are things like managing your blood pressure, knowing your cholesterol numbers and making sure that those are at the appropriate level. If you have diabetes, managing your blood sugar. Sleep, they've added, which is probably my favorite one, because now I'll get less flack on the weekends with my afternoon naps. But having sleep on there, it's really important. It impacts your systems in all different ways. So making sure that also limiting substances. There's emerging science about processed foods and what that does to your body and how that can impact your stroke risk.
Yeah, I just group it all into, and I've been harping on this for years, is lifestyle. It's just lifestyle. We know what's good for us. We know what's not good for us. And it really matters. I'm a big proponent of diet and not going crazy, but there clearly are dietary modifications, exercise. We all know it, but it's so impactful. Jenna said the vast majority of strokes can be prevented. So I'd like nothing more than for the public to put me out of business. I don't see that happening in the near future, but that's what we should strive for. If I'm not needed, if nobody's having strokes, that'd be great.
And let's start with the youth, because a lot of the adult stroke risk factors are developed over a lifetime. So we don't want to scare the children and put stroke on their mind all the time, but sometimes they're the ones who identify it. They'll be sitting with a grandparent who's watching them after school and they notice the signs and symptoms of a stroke, but also we can help them by making those healthy lifestyle decisions early so that they grow up to have those habits and perhaps prevent strokes as they get older. Much easier to not start with those habits and not initiate them than to become an adult, middle age, have already done some of that damage and say, now you have to teach an old dog new tricks. So that would be another thing I'd advocate for, is we have to really give some of this information to our youth so they can prevent it.
Jenna Wydra, Dr. Christopher Comey-Chow, really interesting conversation. We're going to take a quick break here on Living Healthy Together. When we come back, we're going to hear more about stroke risks and maternal stroke risk management. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're talking all about stroke this week in honor of Stroke Awareness Month. We're focusing on the system of care that's been developed to serve patients throughout our region, as well as some emerging clinical focuses, specifically how stroke can affect perinatal patients, those who are expecting to give birth. I'm joined now by Dr. Tracy Madsen, an emergency physician and vice chair of research for Lerner College of Medicine's Department of Emergency Medicine, and Daniela Zambrano, a vascular neurologist, specializes in stroke care at UVM Medical Center. Thank you both for joining us, Dr. Madsen. You're actually the author of a statement on maternal stroke risk and management that was published earlier this year. Can you talk about what this is covering and why the AHA and you felt it was important to issue a statement? Because this is something that's supposed to catch the eye of hospitals across the nation and make this a focus.
So American Heart Association, they really have done a great job of focusing on stroke in women and what the sex differences might be between men and women. And one of the really important areas of sex differences in stroke is, of course, stroke in the maternal period. So people that are pregnant or have just given birth, and we'll talk, I think, more later about why those people are at higher risk for stroke during that time period. But the American Heart Association has really been one of the organizations to shed light on this important issue. And so I, along with many other co-authors, including many vascular neurologists and other specialists like OBGYNs and other types of doctors and researchers, decided that it was a really good time to spread more awareness about stroke in pregnant people and women who have just given birth. And so we decided to write this scientific statement along with the American Heart Association.
Dr. Zambrano, you're someone that works with stroke patients every day and you deal with stroke medicine every day. How is stroke and stroke risk different in maternal patients or perinatal patients than or other populations?
As Tracy was mentioning, when we look at stroke as a whole, the numbers in the population, older population has come down. The stroke in younger people have continued to go up in recent years. And unfortunately, in the community, we still don't identify patients that are young with stroke symptoms as at risk to have a stroke. During pregnancy, that becomes particularly important because many physiological changes that happen during pregnancy that help the safety of the mom, right? So to prevent bleeding after delivery, all this composition of like increasing volume of the blood and trying to prevent bleeding increases the risk of stroke in this population. And these younger women are often contacting multiple healthcare providers, and this is not recognized. So that is why this statement is so important, because it's trying to bring awareness. And as Teresa was mentioning, it's for every single specialty. It's for emergency medicine, it's for OBGYN, it's for primary care. Because the most heartbreaking thing is when you see a patient with a complication like that, you look back and they have contacted multiple people along the way and it just wasn't recognized or appropriately treated.
Dr. Madsen, but what do expectant moms and expectant dads or expectant families need to know? What are the big things that are really important for them in terms of awareness and how to mitigate their risk and seek support and treatment when they need it?
That's a great question. I think one of the really important things to think about for people that are considering pregnancy or already pregnant, the first thing is good prenatal care. So seeing an OBGYN, getting your blood pressure checked, talking to someone about risk factors for stroke. And you bring up a really good point about what are the risk factors for stroke, which pregnant women or which pregnant patients are at higher risk for stroke than others. And so the big things that we think about are high blood pressure and other complications of pregnancy that largely stem from high blood pressure during pregnancy. Preeclampsia is a medical term and that some people may have heard of, some may not, but covers a specific complication of pregnancy that's directly related to high blood pressure. And we know that kind of high blood pressure and related conditions that can happen to pregnant patients, that's the single greatest risk factor for stroke during pregnancy or right after delivering, and can increase risk up to 5 times in some people. So that's really the biggest thing, is making sure that you're seeing an OBGYN, you're getting prenatal care, you're having blood pressure checks, and you're paying attention to warning signs. So that severe headache or new types of headache that you haven't had before, very high blood pressure, and of course, any neurologic symptoms that would suggest stroke or something serious like stroke. So numbness, tingling, weakness, loss of vision. And these are all the really similar signs of stroke that we teach to the general population to be aware of.
What got you interested in maternal or perinatal stroke treatment, risk management?
I really like working with communities and population at large and just providing education for people to recognize the symptoms for a stroke makes a huge difference, because with the treatment that we have now, we see patients that come to the hospital with an ability to speak, an ability to move, and then they walk out of the hospital 2 days later with no deficits. So the first step is recognition. And kind of like going back to that, when I was doing my subspecialty in vascular neurology, I had the opportunity to work with one of my mentors, Dr. Eliza Miller, and she specializes in maternal stroke. They had a big clinic that collaborated with OBGYN with high-risk pregnancies. And unfortunately, we got to see a lot of complications that were referred to that clinic. And again, just like going back and listening to our patients and seeing that they were like actually crying for help. Like they saw so many people before like the big complication happened. So kind of like identifying more risk factors and making sure that we provide prevention, but at the same time, making sure that people know that stroke during pregnancy is treatable. We're so afraid to treat pregnant women that unfortunately care gets delayed or not provided at all because of the risk of damaging the unborn baby. So that is something that I'm very interested about.
What are the things that you hear and see from families most often when someone has a stroke, they're pregnant, and now they have to decide what to do next? What are the things that people don't understand or misunderstand that have a negative impact on patients and families?
People believe that high blood pressure during pregnancy is necessary for the baby to grow and be healthy, but to some point, right? So some people just forget that. Some people forget that high blood pressure or preeclampsia can manifest after the baby was born, and that is a high-risk period. So blood pressure is elevated later on, and we just don't pay attention. The other one is headaches. Overall, headaches can get a little bit worse in the first trimester because the changes in hormones. Usually they do get better in the second trimester, even for patients with a history of migraines. Around like second, third trimester, actually in the third trimester and postpartum, is when most of these hypertensive disorders of pregnancy and preeclampsia can manifest. And one of the symptoms that tells you we are in trouble is the headache. And people just take some Tylenol. They believe like, oh, you know, it's just related to my headaches. And when people come to the ER and the blood pressure is very elevated, it's like, oh, it's elevated because they have a headache. And we're just not putting the like two pieces together. In terms of the treatment, the two main treatments that we have for stroke are clot-busting medications, varistroke and blood thinners that we call thrombolytics. And so the fear with this is, of course, that the baby is going to experience some kind of bleeding event. But truly, the medication doesn't cross the placenta, so it doesn't get to the baby. And number two, of course, in order to diagnose a stroke, we need to do CAT scans. We need to put patients under a lot of tests that can expose them to radiation. But the truth is that the dose that they get exposed to is very, very small compared to what would be necessary to damage the baby. So, and because the same procedure that we call endovascular thrombectomy, which is a procedure that we try to go in with a catheter and try to get the blockage and kind of like remove that blockage, also requires contrast and radiation. People are very afraid that that's going to harm the baby. So that is probably what people are more afraid of.
I know when my wife was pregnant, as the husband, I was scared of everything. The first question is always, how's this going to affect the pregnancy? Is that what this is rooted in, these misconceptions or these fears? Or are they rooted in misunderstandings or cultural factors that are kind of outside of just what I would say, right? It's pretty normal for people to say, I'm just in general concerned about everything right now.
I agree with all of your points, and that generally the thought is that we have to protect the baby at all costs, right? And of course, we want to protect the baby and ensure that people have a healthy pregnancy and the baby's healthy, et cetera. But really, one of the principles that help guide our care when we're seeing people in the emergency department with possible health risks, such as stroke or high blood pressure during pregnancy or other types of things that require imaging or medications, is that if we don't keep mom healthy, if we don't keep the patient healthy, then the baby is not going to be healthy. And so we really have to treat mom first. And that's generally been my principle when talking to patients and their families about, for example, the small risks of radiation that might occur when someone needs a CAT scan during pregnancy, is that we balance the risks and the benefits very carefully. We don't do imaging studies unless they're necessary. But in cases like stroke and other life-threatening conditions, we really have to prioritize mom's health. Otherwise, the baby won't do well either.
I'm going to probably get way out over my skis here. And at least from my own experience watching my wife throughout her pregnancy, someone that is pregnant is dealing with an incredible amount of discomfort and probably has a really high threshold for dealing with discomfort. Daniela, you were talking about headache and high blood pressure kind of being a combo, right? And the fact that you just pop some Tylenol and move on with your life. And now, even if you're not a woman, try to imagine what it might be like, right, for someone who's dealing with all of this, the discomforts associated with going through a pregnancy, right? A headache is nothing. That's so easy to miss, right? I think that's just an incredible kind of nuance of this, that these folks who are dealing with so much, and then it's now, oh, you have to, this thing is probably not even on your radar.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I will add that, I mean, anecdotally, have seen many patients, and particularly women, who have headaches or other neurologic symptoms, and may brush them off or kind of ignore them for a period of time because they're busy doing other things. They're taking care of their other kids. They're taking care of their partners. They're taking care of their parents. And so often women are caregivers and may kind of ignore or disregard their symptoms until they're very severe. And we don't want them to do that. We want patients to seek care when it's necessary. So new headache, severe headache, neurologic symptoms, high blood pressure. It's really important that we're able to diagnose and care for these patients before the consequences are worse and someone has a fake stroke.
One of the things that I always like to remind people is that pregnancy is a high risk period. But even if you have a history of headaches, if the headache is different than your usual headaches, it's a red flag. So any headache that is sudden that comes and within 10 seconds achieves maximum intensity, worst headache of your life, particularly during pregnancy, requires an evaluation. As Tracy was mentioning, if it comes associated with weakness, numbness, problems with speech, it's something that should prompt you to go to the ER right away. If you're taking that Tylenol and Tylenol is not helping, or if there's, of course, like the blood pressure, or if the patient starts becoming confused, not waking up, sleeping for several hours. So that's a different story, right? That's different than the usual headaches. So anything that it should make us seek medical attention.
We've talked a lot in this episode and in a previous episode on stroke about the advances, the structural advances in stroke care. Can you talk about what it's like seeing that from the inside? Is this a really exciting time?
It's a really exciting time. And I'm interested to hear what Daniela thinks too. But in my career as an emergency physician, seeing the advances that have happened, one of the really amazing things about 10 years ago now, around 2015, we saw thrombectomy trials come out. So we saw all of these studies come out about how you can remove the clot from a blood vessel and take a patient who has severe deficits coming into the hospital and they can walk out 2 days later. So that's one of the huge advances we've seen. And even in like since then, so even in the last few years, we're seeing lots of exciting advances about extending the time windows. So extending the time period during which patients can be treated. And so really the goal is to find ways to treat as many patients as possible to help improve outcomes. But I'm interested, Daniela, what has your experience been in your career?
I agree. So, you know, unfortunately, we see a lot of disparities in stroke, right? So we see a lot of gender differences. Again, women usually take a little bit longer to call and to seek help because they're usually trying to brush it off or trying to take care of other people. But also we do see that people that are closer to a bigger center have bigger outcomes. So the ability to extend that time window is so important because from all patients that have strokes, we're able to treat about 18 to 20%. So just recognizing the stroke and developing these systems of care allows people that don't live close to a big center to receive the same care that people who live close to a bigger institution. So in our network, we have a telestroke program. So we connect with the small community hospitals. A stroke neurologist connects to the camera, performs an assessment. We obtain all the imaging, CAT scans, and things like that to try to recognize the type of stroke. And then immediately after this gets recognized, the entire team comes to the hospital and is waiting for the patient. So as soon as they get here, we can provide the care they need. And just in the 6 months, there's so much research just being published in stroke. Just in the last 6 months, we've expanded the window for thrombolytics in select patients. We have up to 4.5 hours before. Now we're expanding it up to like 12 hours in select patients. Again, that's something to come. Same thing with thrombectomy, because now we're concentrating more in how the brain looks like. It's a brain that still looks healthy and we're able to save. And we're kind of moving away from just the time. Because in many cases, what happens is if the patient is unable to speak, or perhaps if they went to bed feeling okay and the stroke happened in the middle of the night, those patients wouldn't qualify for some interventions. But with this new technology, now we're able to treat more and more patients and provide that opportunity to live a life without disability.
Thank you to all our guests. Thank you to Dr. Zambrano, Dr. Madsen. We're all out of time this week on Living Healthy Together. We'll see you next time.